Good afternoon, everyone. My name is John Bauer, and I love ballparks. I have an endless fascination with ballparks, and I've always had a special spot for Comiskey Park since I managed to see the fourth to the last game at Comiskey Park when I was a freshman at Marquette University up the road from here. And I've also been interested in that place where baseball meets business, meets ballparks, meets politics. And the story of the move from one side of 35th Street to the other side is certainly a place where that happens. And so to put into pictures what we're going to talk about, it's going to be the story of how this gave way to this, not this, making sure this never happened. But you can get this for $44.99 on eBay, which allowed this to happen. So, yeah. A little early in the presentation to play to the crowd, but I'll do what I can. And where I'm going to start this story is where I think a lot of great baseball stories begin, which is with Bill Beck. He purchased the Sox for the second time in 1975, saving the team from a possible move to Seattle. But by 1980, an inability to compete financially, along with poor health, led Beck to put the Sox up for sale. In August of that year, he agreed to sell the Sox to Edward DeBartolo Sr. for $20 million. DeBartolo also owned the Pittsburgh Penguins at the time. He would later own the Pittsburgh Maulers, for those nostalgic for the original USFL. But he also owned horse tracks. And that was a problem, along with concerns about a move to New Orleans and an apparent preference by the American League for local ownership. So the American League twice, both in October and in December, rejected the idea of selling the club to DeBartolo. And so while he was trying unsuccessfully to address those concerns about him, there was another real estate mogul in the background, and he happened to be local. Enter Jerry Reinsdorf. He initially partnered with industrialist William Farley in attempting to buy the Sox, but by December, Farley gave way to broadcasting executive Eddie Einhorn as Reinsdorf's principal partner. Together, they were general partners in a group that included 25 limited partners, and in January 1981, completed the sale of the team for $20 million. Neither Vec nor his predecessor, John Allen, had much money to invest in Comiskey Park, so renovations and updates were needed. Though there were rumblings about a new ballpark, the owners went to work on more immediate issues. In the 1981-82 offseason, Comiskey Park was effectively a construction site. Dugouts were widened, thousands of wooden seats were placed with plastic seats, including the so-called golden boxes, and for a cool $5.1 million, a new Diamond Vision scoreboard was installed. Over the next offseason, the Sox installed a couple of dozen skyboxes either side of the press box. They also renovated the concession stands, bathrooms, and team offices. All told, about $15 million were spent over those two offseasons. Despite the investments, the issue of a new stadium never really went away. And so let's move ahead to 1985. There is a quote attributed to Illinois Governor Jim Thompson in several sources where he apparently offered to help get a new stadium. He had been contemporaries with Reinsdorf and Einhorn at Northwestern Law School, but he told them the new stadium wouldn't happen unless people really believed they would move. Comiskey Park celebrates its 75th anniversary of July 1st of that year, and in response to a question about whether Comiskey Park would remain the home of the Sox for much longer, Reinsdorf responds, "I hope not." In fact, Reinsdorf was quite good for an unflattering quote about Comiskey Park. You'll see several in this presentation, and there are plenty more out there. But over the next few years, that quest for a new park intensifies, and there is increasing pressure that the Sox could leave Chicago, if not Illinois. And in this talk for a new stadium, there is a bit of a Chicago focus as well as a suburban focus. First in Chicago. There's discussion about building a dome on an old railroad yard in the South Loop on the east bank of the Chicago River, south of Roosevelt Road. The Chicago Park District superintendent even suggested converting Soldier Field into a multi-purpose dome with a movable grandstand that could accommodate 56,000. That renovation didn't happen, obviously, and from the one that did, we can see how well they preserved the charm and character of the original model. So over the next year, there is this continuing debate about a multi-purpose dome versus a ballpark. That is, there was a desire to find a solution that could also accommodate the Bears, But there was skepticism that a baseball-only stadium could be financially viable. In the burbs, Addison, just southwest of O'Hare, became the focus. It also happened to be where a certain Jerry Reinsdorf's Balfour Company had recently purchased a 140-acre tract of land. He also established the CWS Development Corporation for the purpose of obtaining $100 million in low-interest tax-free bonds. Other developers were doing the same because there was this dynamic where everyone who had a stadium project wanted to be grandfathered in before Congress prohibited the use of tax-free bonds for sports facilities, which it did in the Tax Reform Act of 1986. In January of that year, American League President Bobby Brown inserted himself into the discussion. It was never clear if he did so of his own accord or if he was asked to do so, but he sent the Sox what became known as the Move or Else letter, purportedly telling the team to get a new stadium. Reinsdorf explained that, of course, the American League president knew that staying at Comiskey Park is both a, quote, financial disaster and a, quote, sinkhole of repairs, and just wants to make sure that the club can remain financially stable. It's notable that other teams like the Red Sox and Tigers, who were playing in older stadiums, did not receive similar letters. In Chicago, Mayor Harold Washington is becoming more active. He formed a task force on stadium issues, and he asked two developers, Daniel Shannon and Robert Wislow, to work with the White Sox on that site at the South Loop. But the two sides are seeking two different things. The Sox want a baseball-only facility, while Shannon and Wislow want to build a multi-purpose stadium. And the Sox's initial proposal favored the club so much that the developers said they had to get the Bears into the facility for the building to become financially viable and to pay back the financing. And even at that, they needed the Sox to compromise on some of their financial demands. By summer, Governor Big Jim Thompson is now more closely engaged. He and Washington cobbled together an agreement for a $180 million ballpark project that involved $42 million from the state and $12 million from the city on infrastructure, plus $126 million for the stadium itself to be funded by a 2% increase in Chicago's hotel-motel tax, which was already the second highest in the country. But they can't get the deal through the legislature, and unwilling to wait for the fall session, Reinsdorf now declares Addison to be the exclusive Illinois site for a proposed stadium. Reinsdorf now goes back to Addison to rally support for a 45,000-seat ballpark modeled after what was then called Royal Stadium in Kansas City. Reinsdorf had been an admirer of that park and sought to replicate its design. Washington stated that the White Sox, if they move, can't keep Chicago in their name, and this becomes a minor spat of, no, you can't, yes, I will. And Reinsdorf says, well, Addison is in Iowa. We consider it part of Chicago. We intend to take the name with us. But before the Sox can build, they have a zoning issue to deal with in Addison. The site is zoned for an office park, not a ballpark. Plus, residents concerned about traffic begin to organize through their homeowners associations. Also, part of the site is federally protected wetlands in Bloomingdale Township. So now there's also an issue of EPA approval possibly being required. For the November 1986 ballot, the Sox have three referenda they have to win out in DuPage County. They win the two in Bloomingdale Township, where voters rejected by a 2-to-1 margin, both creating an open space district to buy the land and keep it from development, and also rejecting the proposal to authorize $41 million in bonds to do so. But they lose the one in Addison that would have advised the Board of Trustees to grant the Sox the zoning permit they needed. And they lost it by 43 votes out of 7,500 cast. And even though this wasn't a binding vote, support for the project collapses. But out of crisis comes opportunity. And with the Illinois legislature in a December 1986 session, the White Sox, Washington, and Thompson found enough common ground on a stadium plan for a new park to be built across the street. And building nearby had the advantage that infrastructure costs could be saved. So this made for a bit of a cheaper proposal from what was on the table back in July. And in that agreement, it created what's known as the Illinois Sports Facilities Authority, or ISFA, which was authorized to sell $120 million in bonds from that 2% hotel-motel tax that I mentioned. As part of the agreement, the White Sox agreed to pay $4 million in rent, and cover the maintenance, expected to be about $2 million a year. And remember those figures because we're going to come back to them. Thompson signs the bill at home plate at Comiskey Park in January, and absolutely nothing goes smoothly after that. When you see the spot where they plan to put the ballpark, there are homes and businesses already there, and they certainly have thoughts about the location of a new park. There are neighborhood institutions like McCuddy's Tavern, and the residents are about to have a park dropped on them, and they want to know why the park can't be renovated or built on an existing parking lot or even on Armour Square Park, and they would begin to organize. Now we get into 1987, and the project is stalled for basically two reasons: taxes and spite. One issue is that the Tax Reform Act of 1986 is too specific in the exemption that it allowed for the White Sox Stadium. That exemption referred to the Addison site and the South Loop site, but it said nothing about building a site across the street from the current location. Chicago area Congressman Dan Rostenkowski, who happens to chair the House Ways and Means Committee, needs to find a piece of legislation to which he can attach a fix, and this is going to take a while because Congress. Also, ISFA becomes a source of political theater. Under the law creating it, the governor got to name three board members, the mayor got three, and the governor gets to appoint the chair, but only with the assent of the mayor. Thompson named his appointees and apparently made enough of a show of it at opening day at Comiskey Park that Washington felt upstaged and unprepared. Also, the McCormick Place Management Board was also an issue, and so, seeking leverage, Washington refused to agree to Thompson's pick for the chair, Thomas Reynolds Jr. So July 1, the date for ISFA to come into existence, comes and goes, and ISFA has no functioning board and can't sell the bonds. For good measure, Thompson later vetoed a bill that came out of the Illinois legislature on parking fine collections that Washington wanted, so they were going back and forth. The two men finally settled their differences enough such that by late October, they come to an agreement, Reynolds is appointed chair, and ISFA is up and running by December, 1 year after the bill creating it had passed. Plus, the residents are now organized through the South Armour Square Neighborhood Coalition, and they have allies with a fan group called Save Our Sox, and both groups are pushing the issue of renovation. Reynolds promised to hire an engineering firm to settle the renovation issue once and for all. I should also note that in late January 1988, ISFA appoints Peter Beinow as executive director, and he would later be credited by many as being the driving force behind getting the new park built. But in early 1988, aside from the hiring of lawyers and bond managers, there is not much tangible progress on the stadium project. Enter St. Petersburg, Florida. Without the promise of a team through expansion or relocation, the city was building what was called the Florida Suncoast Dome. We know it today as Tropicana Field. In early 1988, it was a shell. But with the stadium stalled in Illinois, the White Sox began talking with officials in St. Petersburg who believed they can get the dome ready by opening day 1989. But because of its Spartan condition, they had to go to the Florida legislature to get $30 million for important things like dugouts, concession stands, video boards, and suites. The White Sox, meanwhile, put up $25,000 for a study to see if Al Lang Stadium, the then Cardinal Spring training site in St. Petersburg, can be used as a temporary home if needed for the start of the 1989 season. With the offer of a sweetheart lease and the expectation of greater broadcast revenues, the Sox now seek even more favorable terms on their still non-existent lease in Chicago. Specifically, they want to be relieved of much of the rent and maintenance they had committed to paying, which was expected to save them about $60 million. In early May, Thompson's office, specifically Lieutenant Governor James Riley, new Chicago Mayor Eugene Sawyer, Harold Washington had died of a heart attack in his office the prior fall, ISFA and the White Sox are back at the negotiating table. They were hoping to avoid going back to the legislature, but when it turned out they would need to, negotiations suddenly broke off when the White Sox refused a request to break off talks with Florida to give the Illinois legislature time to act. The Sox obviously didn't want to jeopardize the Florida option if the Illinois legislature didn't come through, so they refused. Cooler heads prevailed, and days later there was a deal. Broadly speaking, the White Sox go from $4 million in rent to little or no rent. The state agrees to split the maintenance costs. The Sox agree to share some of the broadcast and advertising revenue if certain thresholds are met. But ISFA is now committed to pay a $5 million penalty if the stadium is not ready by opening day 1991. The city and state are committed to a $10 million annual subsidy, and the bonding authority has jumped from $120 to $150 million. So yes, they have to go back to the legislature. These are big savings for the White Sox, and you can see that the delays prove very costly for the state of Illinois and the city of Chicago. Reinsdorf said the team will stay if the legislature approves the revised deal. But then he and Einhorn head back to Florida to meet with legislators there as well as the governor. Except Governor Bob Martinez is feeling a bit jerked around. So he canceled an expected working meeting at the governor's mansion before offering a perfunctory meet and greet to the two. And you can see his quote there about the stadium situation, about wanting the Sox to resolve whether they want to be Florida's first team or Chicago's second team. But the Florida legislature nonetheless did its part to lure the Sox, passing the $30 million stadium bill in early June. In Illinois, things are not looking good. The governor is trying to rally fellow Republicans. House Speaker Michael Madigan is working on his fellow Democrats. But there are several factors at play. Some are irked by the idea of having to vote on a new bill just 18 months after passing one. Some don't like the optics of subsidizing a stadium while scrambling to fund education and the likelihood of tax increases. And some want assurances about hiring practices with stadium construction. One state senator, Greg Zito, proposed that the legislature appropriate $60 million to buy the White Sox, and this actually passed the Senate by a 2-1 margin. It went nowhere in the House, though. So we get to the final days of June, and everyone is cranky and frustrated. Thompson tells the Sox they have to sign the lease as a precondition to going forward with the bill in the legislature, and the Sox do so on June 29th. Now we get to the 30th. Thompson is working the GOP, Madigan is working the Dems. The Senate passed the bill by a 30-26 vote late on the 30th. I think it was after 11 o'clock. And note, this is a smaller margin than the one to appropriate money to buy the Sox outright. Thompson then goes across the State House, and he's working for votes on the floor of the House. He gets them, and the bill passes with a 60-55 vote. And the time of the vote is the subject of legend. Short of votes and time approaching midnight, the clock was shut off so that the House could work past midnight, even though the Illinois Constitution said it couldn't. But even though it was 12:03 to you and me, it was 11:59 on the floor of the Illinois House, and that was the time that was noted on the enacted bill. And so 1 week later, under the watchful eye of Harold Baines, Thompson signed the bill into law at home plate at Comiskey Park. But now there is work to do because the Sox can break the lease if certain conditions aren't met. And one order of business is acquiring the land. There have been concerns that lawsuits and condemnation proceedings would delay this process. ISFA has until October 15th to get most of the land. They reached an agreement with the Neighborhood Coalition on a relocation plan to help avoid lawsuits, and they generally make above market offers. Oh, and remember that engineering study? Well, it comes back in August and said that it would be too expensive to renovate Comiskey Park, which was never going to happen anyway. So that's what $245K in $1988 got you. And that federal legislation to make ensure the bonds are tax exempt, that passes in October. The bonds are sold in the spring, the project is put out to bid, and when the Stadium Authority was hoping to spend $100 million on stadium construction, the lowest bid is $129.8 million. So in Bino's words, we have a serious problem. Fortunately, everybody huddles, they work together, they find some savings through fewer luxury suites, thinner asphalt in the parking lots, fewer precast concrete panels, and downgrading the sound system. The Sox later agreed to front $7 million for the new scoreboard that ISFA would have to pay back with interest. But on May 7th, shovels are in the ground. And there it is. Construction generally proceeds well. The project generally remains on schedule, if not ahead of schedule. Thompson showed off the construction site to reporters in town for the All-Star Game at Wrigley in 1990. But Comiskey Park has its day with the wrecking ball, which happens on April 3rd. And I will say that as for the park itself, a lot of the commentary about it has been negative, and especially was so at the time. the architects, HOK, now Populous, which said they were trying to find the intimacy of an older park while offering the amenities of a modern stadium. But I guess if Kauffman Stadium in Kansas City is your guide, then the product is going to look much different than the original. But the arched windows were carried over, along with picnic areas, pinwheels on top of the scoreboard. One thing that actually moved was the infield dirt that had been carefully manicured over the years. But I will say that one person who liked it was Sparky Anderson. He called it the best, he said it might be the best ballpark ever. But he was probably in a cheerful mood because his Tigers beat the White Sox 16-0 at the stadium's first game. And just finally, I will put in a plug for, I wrote an article in the Sabre publication on Comiskey Park a few years ago. This is focused more on the events of May and June 1988, so if this topic interests you, check that out. If you're curious about where I sources for the reading, and hopefully I allowed some time for questions.
Did you ever, in your research, investigate Philip Bess's proposal for Armour's Square?
I did, and I came across an article. It's on, if anyone's curious, email me and I'll send you the link. No, a very interesting piece that would have been a ballpark that probably would have been truer to the neighborhood, a better ballpark design, less disruptive to the neighborhood. I did come across, so not only the article on CBS Sports a few years ago, but he presented that park as a proposal to ISFA, but was generally met with indifference by all sides. But might have been an improvement on what came.
In light of the previous presentation about reproducing your park, did they ever consider actually just reproducing the exact copy of Comiskey Park?
I don't think so. Nothing that I came across. I think part of it was, you know, some of the complaints about the posts in the lower deck to support the upper deck. I think also that Reinsdorf was particularly fascinated with Kauffman Stadium in Kansas City, and I think having so many more seats between the foul poles was something that attracted him.
I can recall taking my son to that ballpark the second year and finding out that there was 29 rows in the upper deck, and also finding out that you could see Lake Michigan, and you're not supposed to be able to see Lake Michigan from that location.
I will just note that if he was trying to copy Kauffman Stadium, that is one feature that he definitely carried over, because for those of you who've been there, if you're from Kansas City, I lived there a long time, that upper deck is steep.
Great presentation.
Thank you.
I saw a quote on one of your last slides there from Jerry Reinsdorf about, you know, the old stadium and stuff. Were you surprised to see that kind of comment from such an upstanding guy who clearly loves to give baseball so much?
Shocked. It was shocking. One more question. And then I'll hang around if anybody wants to keep talking. I'm here. So
in the 80s, the team on the other side of town, the Cubs, also almost moved to Schaumburg, which is now where the Schaumburg Boomers play. In your research, did you like do any comparison of the two proposals, and was it like any different than what was going on the south side?
No, I didn't look. I did not research any Schaumburg proposal for the Cubs. But what was interesting is the comparison of how the neighborhoods were treated,
okay.
And that is that the South Armour Square neighborhood, it was sort of a done deal, and there was little concern for the people who were living there, whereas they contrasted their situation with those on the north side, where there was a lot of concern for the neighbors who were concerned about the installation of lights at Wrigley Field. And that was something that also underscored the Sox's concern, is that if they were going to start playing night games at Wrigley Field, it might cut into their opportunities to play games and have eyeballs on their televised games.
Thank you.